Hello, and welcome to Artistas in the Capital. My name is Norma Sorto, and I'm your host for Hola Cultura's brand new monthly podcast, featuring interviews with Latinx artists in the Washington area. Literature has played a crucial role in the culture of Latin America and its people. Authors represent their rich and tumultuous history in a mythical yet realistic way. The region's many Nobel Prize winners in literature inspire a passion that Latin Americans often bring with them as they migrate to the United States, belying stereotypes perpetuated by decades of marginalization and bias. Surmounting the obstacles, Latino authors have embedded Latino literature into American culture and the melting pot story of the United States. Nicolas Canelos is one of the leading voices in this U.S. Hispanic literary movement. In this month's episode, our guest Nicolas is an author, editor, and the founder of Arte Público Press, the country's oldest and most established Hispanic publishing house, based out of the University of Houston. For decades, he has elevated Latino representation in American literature and helped launch best-selling writers such as Sandra Cisneros, author of The House on Mango Street. From founding a Latino-centered magazine in the 1960s to expanding Arte Público into children's book publishing, Nicolas has advanced the portrayal of Latinos in literature told by Latin Americans themselves. Through the many years, he has been dedicated to recovering written material dating back to the 16th century, ensuring the legacy of Latinos in the United States through literature. Here is our interview with Nicolas, conducted by Spell participants Fernanda Poblete Gonzalez, Jacqueline Perpilia, and Deanna Gonzalez back in November of 2021.
I guess I'll start from the beginning. In the 1960s, late 60s, early 70s, I was heavily involved in the Latino civil rights movement, doing street theater and marching and boycotting and protesting and signing up people to vote and poll watching and todo el rollo. And it became evident to my friend Luis Davila and I, who were both involved in literature, that there were so many writers and artists around who didn't have any place to publish their works. So we founded a magazine called Revista Chicano Riqueña. I was the Riqueño part and he was the Chicano part. But from the beginning, we decided that the magazine would be national in scope and be open to all the different Latinos in the United States, regardless of their ethnicity or race. And we hoped that it would bring them together and create an overall movement and aesthetic kind of blend of Latinos. The magazine did very well in the 1970s because basically there was no literature being published or very little literature being published by Latinos. So the individual issues of the magazine were being used as textbooks in many classes. And because Luis and I were in academia, we had that whole network of universities and colleges available to us for promotion and circulation. By 1979, we decided that our special issues did well by themselves, and we figured, well, we can publish books if we can do this with a magazine. So in 1979, we founded Arte Público Press specifically to publish books. And what we did was, of course, we went to all the people that we were publishing in our magazine during the 1970s to kick off the press. So we went to people like the New Eurekans, Tato Laviera, Miguel Piñero, Miguel Algarín, Piri Thomas, Nicolás Amor. We went to Tomás Rivera, Rolando Hinojosa, Luis Leal, Sandra Cisneros, Ana Castillo, etc., again, who we had published in the magazine, to start off our press. And in the early 1980s, that's exactly what we did. We started the press publishing individual works by Latinos with whom we have developed a relationship. One of the big breaks that we got was when in the early to mid-1980s, the leadership universities in the United States decided to democratize their curriculum, and they began to create reading lists for freshmen that included so-called third world authors, writers like Maxine Hong Kingston, The Color Purple, and various other works that were different instead of the old white men that had been traditionally studied. And one of the books that they included in their list was The House on Mango Street. So all of a sudden, people went to the bookstores all over the country looking for the house on Mango Street, and they couldn't find it. So bookstores found us, and finally we started selling to bookstores, and we began to be known as a publishing house outside of academia and to fulfill orders from bookstores and public libraries. So that was our first dip of our toe into what's called the trade. The trade is basically the commercial publishing establishment that runs from the major publishing houses for the most part through the pages of the book reviews like the New York Times Book Review and Publishers Weekly into the bookstores, especially the chain bookstores, and the cycle of subsidiary rights that go from including material in textbooks and anthologies to inviting authors to some of the headlining performances at museums and libraries around the country. So we, of course, began to learn about that and to become more astute at producing books that could get into the trade. So the idea that you will get from this is that there is less and less opportunity for ethnic, regional, specialized books to be noticed and to be sold, because not only the libraries, but the bookstores order books based on reviews. So the reviewing instruments for commercial books are the newspapers and the TV that get out to the populace. But the reviewers that are for libraries or for universities, they're much more smaller, and they're more likely targets for a small publishing house like us or ethnic publishing house. Let me just say that there is less opportunity to publish Latino books today and get them noticed and reviewed than there was back in 1992. So this is not to let you down, but this is to inform you what the playing field is like right now as far as literary publishing, as far as nonfiction publishing, as far as getting our voices out into the world and getting our culture recognized and integrated into popular culture in the United States and integrated into the educational system K through graduate school. It's difficult. There's a lot of barriers, and there's lots of room for more Latino publishing houses. There's lots of room for more Latino magazines. There's lots of room for more Hola Cultura. But the first thing that needs to be done was what we took care of back when was the business end. Everyone has an aesthetic. Everyone has an artistic vision. But getting the business together, getting the accounting together, getting the funds and managing them well is the most important part. Because without your financial basis, you have no aesthetic, you have no vision. So that is why most of the small presses and small magazines go under, because they don't take care of business, so they don't know how to take care of business. The next thing that we did in our development was we decided to grow our audience. But we also wanted to start publishing children's books because there was a great need. Basically, Latinos did not, and still to a large extent, do not see themselves in children's literature. They don't see themselves in the books in school. They don't see themselves in the curriculum. They don't see themselves in the reading hours. They don't hear their language. So we founded Piñata Books for Children and Young Adults, I think it was like 1993, 1994, to give kids and families the opportunity to see themselves in books, hear and read the way they speak, see their homes, their families, not in Mexico or Venezuela, Argentina, España, Puerto Rico, but the way they live in the United States. Our kids going to school and going to libraries in the United States need to see themselves, because we already know what the all-white washout, whiteout experiences through education. So if they're going to learn to read and identify with schools and pursue careers and not have the high dropout rates that they eventually have, they have to start identifying with books and learning. So we publish three divisions in Piñata Books. We publish bilingual picture books. And picture books are very interesting because not only do we have a linguistic signature in our books, but the visual language comes from Latino culture. We work with Latino artists and illustrators. So we publish bilingual picture books. We publish middle readers, or what teachers call chapter books. And then we publish books for young adults. The young adult Latino reader is the most neglected of all of the readers. There's hardly anyone producing young adult literature for Latinos by Latinos. So that was our next big step. And Piñata Books for us have been a great, great success, especially with the growth of the Latino population and the growth of the Latino school population. So not only are we selling hundreds of thousands of books of these children's and young adult books, but we're also licensing. Licensing is one of the biggest avenues for success and for revenue in the publishing business. It means what you publish gets transformed into other genre, other forms. And in today, it's online availability. The 1990s was a very incredibly active and fruitful decade for us, because not only did we learn the trade, and not only did we launch Piñata Books, but also we looked backward. With Piñata Books was looking forward to growing our readers, we established Recovering the U.S. Hispanic Literary Program, Recovering U.S. Hispanic Literature. What it actually is a program to find all of the written culture, not just literature, diaries, correspondence, unpublished works, family memoirs, treaties, libros de cocina, whatever you can imagine that's been written by Latinos in the United States from the colonial period, that's from the beginning of the 16th century up until the 1960s. So we engaged in an active program to find all of the writing created by Latinos in the United States. And that included immigrants and included exiles, included gente de paso, who just spent some time in the United States. If they left a written legacy in the United States, we were going to find it and recover it. And so that's what we have been doing since then. We have been recovering the actual documents when families or resources let us take them, or we do what's called post-custodial archiving, which is making copies of the documents, of the books, of the 600-page books, of the memoirs, of the correspondence, making digitized copies. So we digitize with microfilm for preservation, and we digitize all of that knowledge, all of that writing, we put into digital form and create large databases of these documents of this Latino thought. And one of the strongest and most important parts of that legacy is the newspapers. We have become the place for the history of Latino journalism. We have the largest collection of Latino newspapers published from the very first one, published in New Orleans in 1808, El Mississippi, to the large dailies like La Prensa de Nueva York, La Opinión de Los Angeles, and so on and so forth.
I wanted to know, why did you decide to write immigrant literature, El Sueño del Retorno? I was wondering about, like, your inspiration.
Well, I grew up with and I've always been surrounded by Latino immigrants. Throughout history, of course, Latinos have been denigrated, and immigrants in general are very misunderstood, and Latino immigrants in particular have been demonized, not just recently in the last presidency, but over the decades have been demonized. And I'm very familiar through all the research that I've done, working with all the old texts, that Latino immigrants have contributed greatly to the United States and have their own literature. And no one knew about this, and they have their own opinions. And the opinions that I saw in the works that Latinos wrote and published, for instance, in the newspapers of the 1920s or 1930s, and what American literature and culture think immigrants write was completely different. Mm-hmm. Because Latino immigrants always yearn to return to their homeland. They came here, especially when I define immigrants as economic refugees. They have always wanted to return to the homelands and preserve their culture. It was not the case that has been trumpeted through education that they came here wanting to forget their culture, forget their language, and adopt the culture of the United States. They didn't want to leave their culture that has been demonized as a culture of poverty behind to acquire a new superior culture. What they wanted to do was feed their families and have access to good education and opportunities. But at the end of the road, many of the original immigrants wanted to be buried in their homeland, or at least go back and with their earnings, have a little house or whatever. It was completely different from the European immigrant story. So that was one of the motives for me writing that book and proving it, proving these theses by citing the works of Latino immigrant writers. So contrary to the beliefs that, first of all, working class people do not have a culture, working class people do not have a literature, working class people do not have art, Latino immigrant literature or Hispanic immigrant literature proves that Latino writers, immigrant writers, and working class writers have concepts of art, literature, and culture, and could produce works of art that are worthy of study, remembering, and becoming part of the American legacy. That's why.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, you have to understand that back in the 1970s, I was using the newspapers, going wherever there were newspapers, Latino newspapers in collections, like at University of California, Berkeley, or the Library of Congress. And I was accessing those newspapers to find out about theater. So I would read all those newspapers and get all the theatrical productions in Spanish. And eventually it became my book that was published in the early 1980s, The History of Hispanic Theater in the United States. But as I was doing this, of course, I ran into lots of other material, lots of writing, lots of art, lots of culture in those same newspapers that were obvious. So all along from the 1970s till I published the book on Hispanic immigrant literature, I had been accumulating data, but also recovering the U.S. Hispanic literary heritage, which gave me all kinds of tools, the internet, digital tools to bring all this stuff close at hand so I could read it and be able to form a book. So you might say it took 20 or 30 years to produce that book, but actually sitting down and writing it only took me 2 years.
What did you want to teach to your readers with your book?
I want them to become more familiar with what the kinds of authors and the kinds of works that Latinos produced who were immigrants and writing for an immigrant public. But I wanted them also to respect working class culture and to respect our people in general, because, you know, I may be saying this wrong. When Saul Bellow got the Nobel Prize, he was a professor at the University of Chicago, and they celebrated with him giving a big speech. And he turned around and he pointed to 18th Street in Chicago, the Mexican neighborhood. And he said something on the order of, "Today's immigrants are not like us. We came with the culture of the book and the culture of reading." Latino illiteracy has been grossly, grossly overemphasized. It's a lot easier to learn to read Spanish than it is English. And Latinos historically have used the newspapers to read and have been self-taught in reading. Now, literacy in English, that's another story completely. But we have never been without literature and without reading and without reading manner. What happens is that newspapers were the primary genre, not published books, because they were more immediate. They were cheaper. They were in the neighborhoods. There weren't many Latino Spanish language bookstores at all. But newspapers, we have rescued some 1,500 of them, and we're still finding more.
What part of the book, El Sueño del Retorno, was the most fun to write?
Back in 1985, I was in Mexico and I found a novel of immigration called Las Aventuras de un Chipote o Cuando los Pericos Mamen, which is a satirical take on Mexican immigration to the Southwest. And it deals with a poor country bumpkin who comes to the United States thinking that he's going to sweep up gold from the streets of the U.S., you know, and make his fortune and so on. He believes all this propaganda, you know, about the wealth of the U.S. and the ability to make money here. It's a humorous satiric novel by Daniel Venegas. So that has always been fun, reading it, teaching it, and writing about it, because the author was a self-taught author who came to the United States as a laborer, worked on the railroads, worked as a dishwasher, so on and so forth. And many of those experiences are in the novel. But he also published a newspaper, and he gathered the stories And he wrote the different stories in like four or five different voices in the newspaper. Some would be cultured, other would be, you know, a man on the street, other would be very satirical. And he did all of the illustrations by hand, and he printed the newspaper by hand, and then he went and he carried the newspaper to the stores all around Los Angeles, and then he went and picked up and collected the money for the sale. And from those humble beginnings, he became the president of the Latin American Newspaper Association of California. So it was very interesting.
Yeah.
But the novel itself is a riot, and it has survived. It's been in three different editions, two editions in Mexico, actually two editions of ours because we translated it. So we publish it in Spanish, we publish it in English as The Adventures of Don Chipote or When Parakeets Suckle Their Young.
I wanted to ask you about that, about the translation. Why did you decide to publish and translate Against the Wall stories?
Against the Wall, Contra la Muralla by Alberto Robles. This is the problem. If you publish a book in Spanish, there isn't sufficient reviewing mechanisms in the United States to recognize the book and to let people know that it exists. Because the newspapers, for instance, will not review a book in Spanish. And Publishers Weekly will not review a book in Spanish. And for the most part, Library Journal will not review a book in Spanish. So the whole review mechanism, and because we don't have many Spanish language bookstores, the distribution mechanisms, the wholesalers, is all at a disadvantage for publishing a book in Spanish. So one of the ways to success is to translate the book to English, publish the English version first, get it reviewed all over the place, and then based on the English reviews, use those English reviews to convince librarians and teachers and everybody else that the Spanish original is worth having and studying. So we are working with what the market tells us, the market the way it's constituted today, unfortunately, that we don't have an infrastructure for original books in Spanish published in the United States. We have an infrastructure for importing books from Spain and Latin America, and we have an infrastructure for translating books from Spain and Latin America. Although, of all the major languages, French, German, Russian, etc., Spanish is the least translated language for books.
What stories would you think are the most important now, like these days, based on like what's going on in our society?
I think that the stories in Against the Wall are right on for right now. They speak exactly to what has been going on in the culture, and that's a great factor in the decision to publish them. It's a collection of stories. Some of them are about immigration. A lot of them are about movement, about traveling. Some of them are about accommodation to culture in the United States. But the first couple of stories really deal with the satirizing, even to a Kafkaesque sense, the whole issue of fear of immigrants. Like in the very first story that we opened the collection with, people wake up in Washington, D.C. to find the Washington Monument covered with roaches. And so the whole city goes into a panic and trying to figure out what happened. How did this come about? How do we deal with it? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Later, it becomes evident that it's a metaphor for immigrants and their role in the fear of immigrants and taking over the United States. It's a great story. In fact, when we apply for support from the National Endowment for the Arts, they're one of the funders that we go to. They ask that when you put in your application, you have to give 5 pages of each book that you want to publish. So I submitted that story and we got the funding.
Is there a particular type of story that you find most effective in combating this fear of immigrants? Do you find that it's stories like the one you just described that tackle that topic directly? Or do you find that having more stories that tell different narratives do that more subvertly?
Well, I think that subtlety is the best. Actually, the story about the Washington Monument is very subtle and it's kind of magic realist and they're highly literary. I would be opposed to something that's very prosaic and political. Political essays are important, but not as fiction. So I see a very strong dividing line between political writing and writing literature that may deal with social issues. As far as I'm concerned, all literature deals with social issues, one way or another. All literature has a political stance, but the way you deal with it makes it art or not. So that's where the dividing line is. Because if we're publishing literature, we're looking for art.
Thank you, Nicolas, for your interview with Hola Cultura. Join us next month, where we speak with educator, researcher, choreographer, and performer, Gabriel Mata. For updates on episodes and Latinx events in the DC area, follow us on Instagram at HolaCulturaDC. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Artistas en el Capital. To get involved in Latinx arts, culture, and humanities in DC, sign up to join our SFOL program and visit HolaCultura.com.